Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest tonight is Michael Craig, author of the intriguingly titled book, The Professor, The Banker, and The Suicide King. We'll also be talking to him about other recent things he has written. We had an email addressed to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. A player we'll call Joe wants to play for low stakes at several different Boyd properties in Las Vegas, hoping to stay under the radar and still earn some comps for his next visit. Richard, what do you think of the plan?
Well, I think earning comps for your next visit at Boyd Properties is a good idea. I mean, they are the easiest place to get lots of hotel room offers out of. But on the other hand, they're some of the sweatiest places in town. So what I would say is figure that when you make your next trip, if you're going to come for 4 days or something, figure you're going to pick up $300 or $400 in EV based on those comps on your next trip. So don't count cards and use a spread that's going to get you heat on this trip. If you want to do your card counting, do it at other casinos and just go put in some time at the Boyd properties with a very small spread, maybe a break-even type spread, realizing that the EV you're going to pick up is on your next trip when you get those free rooms and maybe some meals out of them. Because they are very quick to bar people there. So, and it's really dangerous, because you're going to be using a player's card. So if they do bar you, they're going to have your name, and your name is now going to be, you know, toast at all the Boyd properties in town. So that would be my suggestion.
All right. We had another email from a different blackjack player. We'll call him Pete. And he's playing an 8-deck game, 50% penetration. Dealer stands on soft 17, double after split, late surrender. However, no resplitting. He's increased his bankroll so far from $100 to $2,400 and wants to know if he's just gotten lucky or if he really has an advantage.
I was laughing out loud when I read this email. So there are a lot of players. This comes up on the message boards every couple of months. You know, somebody new to counting cards discovers online blackjack where they have these shoes cut in half. So your question, had you just got lucky? Yes,
big
you
time.
Got incredibly lucky. And your risk of ruin is probably about as close to 100% if you continue to play this game. There's very little you can do as an American player. They made it very difficult to get money in and out of online casinos. But so I don't know if this player, is playing in Europe or something. But I would say if you want to try to attack online casinos, the money is not in counting cards. You know, investigate the bonus money they'll give you for signing up. You might be able to find some good EV there that'll be way, way more than you would ever get trying to count cards on an 8-deck game cut in half.
All right. On a recent show, I mentioned a basketball free throw contest that will take place at the Borgata on March 21st. I suggested that a number of college basketball players will enter. It turns out there's professional free throw shooters who typically shoot with greater than 98% accuracy on a regular basis. At least two of them from Australia are flying in for the contest. Now, this can't be a smart move financially unless you're very confident. I check round-trip tickets from Melbourne to New York, not the only places of origin and destination, but I wanted a rough idea of the prices, and the cheapest I found were above $1,300. You need to win first or second place to recoup that, and if you're here, you'll probably want to spend a week or so in the United States traveling. After all, 24-hour airline trips each way are no picnic, so if you're going to undergo that, you're going to want to do more than just play basketball free throws for a half day before you get back on the plane again. So, entries are limited to 750, including rebuys. Now, I know Richard and I both have plans for March 21st, so those of you who feared competing against us can now breathe easier. Whether or not they travel to Atlantic City, I could see some sort of prop bet among poker players here in Vegas as to who would do the better in this. Now, I don't know of any such prop bets at the current time, but it wouldn't surprise me. Now, Michael Craig, we haven't really introduced you yet, but are you practicing for this contest?
I think if I got involved in a free throw contest, the over-under on how I would do would be about 40 to 50%. I'm assuming that if I practiced a little, maybe I could get up to 50, 55%. I imagine that that's probably not going to be good enough to win at the Borgata, so I would back Huckseed in the contest. But, yeah, I think he would do among the best in the poker community. But I think I'll probably pass on this one and wait for a better opportunity for me.
I'm shocked. I didn't read that about it being limited to 750 people because the top prize is only $5,000.
Yes.
And the entry fee is only $25 or something.
$20.
So the casino is – why would they limit – that seems odd. But I think we could get a free throw contest here in Las Vegas with prize money of 10 times that with just, you know, some of the poker players here easily. I think you could get a bet of $50,000 on a free throw contest.
Now, the Borgata says if they actually break even and they more than break even – the money's going to go into the prize pool.
How can they break even if it's $20 to enter and they're limiting it to $750, and they're paying out $5,000?
Well, 20 times 750, isn't that
$15,000? Oh, yeah. You're right.
All right.
But
Love it when he does. I've made those decimal point mistakes, and he catches me every time. Bingo. I feel so good. All right. Now, Richard, I hear there's an interesting promotion up. You know, the folks who used to be called Cantor Gaming. Tell us about that.
Oh, so Cantor Gaming has a deal where if you bet through their app, you get a 5% loss rebate every month. So now normally with loss rebates, you want to try to take a big swing on something with very high variance. But because this is only 5%, it's not really that attractive as a promotion, but if you're a sports bettor already and you're trying to get money down, it seems like you might as well put it through the app where at the end of the month you might be getting your 5%. You know, I don't know how much action they'll take. I mean, you could make, you know, one $10,000 bet, and if you win it, continue to bet, and if you lose it, put your action down somewhere else. You know, Cantor, I guess, also is pretty quick to bar people. So that's one of the downsides of using the app is they're going to know who you are pretty quickly and whether you're a sharp player. So,
well, if I were betting, I would bet one bet, win or lose, and then wait till next month to make another bet so that I'm getting the full 5% every time I lose and there's no real vig when I win. Because if I am ahead, then the promotion doesn't mean anything to me until I lose back the $10,000. So I would make one bet, as big as I can afford. Now, they won't take bets more than – you only can do the rebate up to $5,000, which means you can't bet more than $100,000, which in my case would not be a strong barrier. But I think I'd make one bet a month.
Yeah,
for the biggest they take.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about trying to just take advantage of the rebate, which – for a 5% rebate, I don't think it's really worth the time to go after. But if you're a sports bettor anyway, you know, then certainly if you have options of where you can get your money down, then, you know, I would start out making my bets through the app, and then once I had a loss booked, I would move my action elsewhere.
I would stop it whether I had a loss or not. All right, so be it. Let's talk to our guest. Michael Craig is a poker player. He's an author, writer, and a lawyer. He's best known in the gambling community as the author of The Professor, Banker, and the Suicide King, Inside the Richest Poker Game of All Time. Michael Craig, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Well, thanks very much for having me. I'm a big fan of the show.
Well, thank you. Now, why don't you take about 10 minutes and tell us about the book, and then we'll ask you some questions from there.
The book actually came out in 2005, so its 10th anniversary is coming up. It's a story of a series of high-stakes poker games, extremely, extremely high-stakes poker games, between Andrew Beal, a billionaire banker from Texas, who wanted to play the best poker players in the world heads up as sort of a hobby game situation challenge, the sort of thing that billionaires can do if they want to. And he took on the best poker players in Las Vegas. The book covers a period 2001 through 2004. He started out playing heads up against the top pros, limit hold'em, bets of $10,000 and $20,000. And by the end of it, they were playing games in 2004 where the bets were $100,000, $200,000 on each street. There were times when he got seriously ahead and the poker players started to panic, not so much because of real financial ruin, but turning on each other. How could you lose this amount to him? You know, somebody would lose 50 bets or something in a day, and they'd say, "Well, I told you that guy was no good at hold'em anyway." They were like the regular punters that get a bad beat and then go off and skulk about it. Except these are the best players in the world, and they're not used to being team players, and so you get those conflicts going on. You also have situations where Beal gets way behind and catches up, or situations where he just disappears for several months or actually even more than a year and comes back. And so there's a certain amount of drama in the action. It's not an instructional book or a book about individual poker situations. I actually wrote this book without being present for any of the games. I wrote a couple of extremely long articles when they played in 2007, actually getting to sit at the table, and I described a lot of hands in detail in those articles. But the book, The Professor, The Banker, and The Suicide King, was written entirely from interviews conducted after. So there are only a half dozen or so actual hands described in the book. It's really more about a billionaire banker, Andrew Beal, and what his motives are for wanting to try to conquer high-stakes poker and try to figure out a way to match his skills and his resources against the best players in the world. Of course, there's only so much you can do to learn poker when you're playing against people like Doyle Brunson or Chip Reese or Todd Brunson or Howard Lederer or Ted Forrest. And so he used his bankroll as an additional weapon, trying to play them higher than they'd ever played before and hoping that they would make less than optimal decisions in that circumstance. He also tried to educate himself as much as he could about the game. And I think that the general consensus, and I don't think this was just to say nice things about the guy they won a bunch of money from, is that he became a very good player. And I think a number of people said to me, if Andy Beal played any place but the highest stakes heads-up games, he would probably kill the games. And one of the things that you have to say is that if you only play against the best players for high stakes, you're going to learn really quickly about how to play. You may not be able to beat that game, but you could take that to smaller games. And I learned from my involvement in poker and learning about high stakes poker players that there are a lot of guys who are the loser and the guy throwing the party in the big game, where people will say, "Oh yeah, that guy's terrible. He's lost millions of dollars, in the big game at the Bellagio, the big game at the Aria." These are actually guys who can afford to lose that kind of money, who if they played, like a 75-150 game or something like that, would kill the game and beat up on some extremely good players, but they don't want to play a $75, $150 game. They want to play, a $4,000, $8,000 game, or they want to play no limit, for a $500,000 or $1 million as the buy-in. And so, one of the things that was fascinating to me about the story was about, how high-stakes poker works. And while Beal's motives and his strategies, including things like a little mechanical device that he wore to help him randomize his decisions, things like that, that was interesting to me is learning about the lives of professional poker players. And a lot of people listening to this are probably members of the community. But I think that there's a tremendous interest in, you know, the lives of people who, you know, try to find edges in gambling situations, and both how they do that, how they're opposed, whether, you know, it's for advantage players by, you know, by casinos, or, you know, limitations placed on them, potential heat, or whether it's something like poker where they're actually butting heads with each other to, you know, to find out who the better player is and to take advantage of each other's weaknesses. These are interesting people who lead interesting lives. And one of the things that I'm really proud of about the book is that I got an opportunity to introduce a large audience to people like Ted Forrest, who you know, ran a marathon on the 4th of July in Las Vegas to win a $25,000 bet, or Howard Lederer, who at one time was homeless living in New York after he ran away from home to become a chess player in New York City and had all his money stolen, and just about the just, you know, the ups and downs of life of professional gamblers. The book did really well. It's been well reviewed. I never get tired of hearing great things about it. I was at my urologist's office for the first time, and my urologist looked at my chart and said, Michael Craig, you're not the Michael Craig who wrote The Professor, the Banker, and the Suicide King. And I said, yeah. And so I got to hear that, you know, my urologist just got back from a vacation where he read the book and loved it. Or I was at a bat mitzvah. I used to live in Chicago, and I went back there. It was a friend's daughter being bat mitzvahed, and I knew him and a few other people, but I was not at a table where I knew anybody. And just in making small talk with the other guests, we were talking about what we did for a living, and I'd ask the guy next to me what he did, and I'm interested in what people do for a living. And we talked for quite a while, and then he asked me what I did, and I mentioned to him that I was an author. And he asked the kind of books that I write, and I mentioned that I'd written, you know, at the time, I'd written four books at that time, and I said, the last two have been about poker. And he said, really, I've read some about poker. And I mentioned The Professor, the Banker, and the Suicide King, and he said, oh my God, you wrote The Professor, the Banker, and the Suicide King? And he, like, stood up and went around to other people at the bat mitzvah that he knew at other tables and said, I can't believe I'm sitting next to the guy who wrote my favorite book ever. Things like that have only happened to me a couple times, but it's just really cool when, you know, you have a situation where, you know, you just kind of, like, cast a net out randomly and find people that, you know, like and read your work. Of course, plenty of times I've sat at poker tables and just kind of, like, dropped the hint that I wrote the book so that I could invite somebody to say something nice about me. But, you know, that's probably my own neediness. But, you know, in fact, it was a great experience. The book was well received. As I said, I got to know Andy Beal. I got to know these top professionals really well. I feel like it was an honest account. You know, there were certain things that people told me off the record, but in general, it was no holds barred. I wasn't trying to make one side look better, one side look worse, present a particular view. I just wanted to show people this interesting world. And I don't think I made any enemies among the participants in the book. And over the next few years, I ended up writing about a number of them. And when Andy Beal came back to play a couple years later in a series of games, started mostly because he thought players were talking smack about him or didn't sufficiently respect him in in some of their comments and other publications, I got to sit there at the table and watch. And that would have been a great Gambling with an Edge if you'd had me on then, because I was sitting at the table for 13 days watching $50,000 and $100,000 limit hold'em, and watching a game where Ted Forrest was ahead by $8 million by noon and had lost it back by 5 o'clock, or when, when Phil
That's
Ivey.
That's a tough afternoon.
Yes. Oh, the last day of it, Andy Beal lost $10 million in one day to Phil Ivey. And it was just, beyond fascinating. I mean, I'm watching Ivey is winning hand after, he's not winning every hand, but he's, winning. And Andy, I can feel, is like, he's getting desperate. Like, he's been there for a number of days. I mean, it's sort of like, the gambler that shows up with X amount of dollars and after losing like three quarters of them just starts like making bigger bets because it's like, well, I better like start winning or just lose it all. And he's doing this with what started the day at $10 million in front of him. And so, you know, Ivy is just, you know, cleaning up on him. And, you know, and then at the same time, it's like, the you know, I found out there was some sort of explosion at a power plant a couple miles away that involved like some of the Bellagio, actually the wind, some of the wind's power source. And so the poker director at the time had, you know, said to me like that evening that, you know, like she's looking around, you know, because she's worried that this is, you know, an attempt to, you know, like to steal the $20 million in chips that are on the table, to take advantage of some power outage. So the, I mean, that would have been an interesting book if it had been true. But the, you know, there, you know, there are just all these interesting things going on. And so I, you know, I got that other perspective on it. And I've subsequently, you know, been in touch with Andy Beal. I've written numerous times about and collaborated with the poker pros in the book. I consider them friends, or at least am friendly with just about all of them. And the game, as you know, you've mentioned on the show, and a lot of the people listening to the show probably know, the game still goes on. Andy Beal showed up in Las Vegas the end of January, played $5 million. You know, I don't know if they played a $5 million freeze out, or he and Todd Brunson just played heads up and they started with $5 million. But as I understand it, Todd won $5 million from Andy, and Andy's response was to stand up and give Todd a high five. Yeah, which I thought was pretty cool, and definitely in the spirit of the games as I learned about them and watched them.
I you know, one of the things that I learned in the book that I hadn't known was in the beginning of the book, Ted Forrester, it was driving all night from L.A. or
Ted
something,
Forrest.
And he shows up and he sees, I believe it was Chip Reese, playing this enormous stakes heads up match, and the part that I didn't know was you're allowed to sit down at any table that is being played, right? You can't have a heads up match. And so Ted Forrest didn't know they had made some arrangement, and basically went and, even though I don't think he had slept for 24 hours or something, went and got all his chips out of his box to go sit down at the table with Chip and this guy.
Exactly. And it's a great story, and I feel like a great introduction to the book. And when I was researching it and talking with the people involved, as well as with the Bellagio's poker manager, Doug Dalton, with Eric Drake, who was a poker room manager for years and years and years in Las Vegas. And I said, you know, how, you know, if two guys play, you know, can somebody else just walk into the game? And it's kind of like a controversial point. It's like, well, you know, it's bad etiquette if somebody's in a game and, you know, somebody else just walks in. But on the other hand, it's a public game, and you can't, you know, you can't keep people from playing in it if it's being played in public, you know, in a regulated casino. And so Ted, who was out of town when Beal came, you know, showed up, and they put together this group. I mean, the group was put together partly because Beal insisted on playing heads up. He felt that he would get, you know, that there wouldn't be Confederates working against him if he's playing just one person. And also that he felt like he had better control of the game heads up. You know, he could figure out poker better if it was heads up than a ring game. Also, he liked to gamble, and you can gamble more heads up. So he wanted to play heads up. He wanted to play big, big enough that they needed to pool their money. But also the players around, they all wanted to take a shot at him. Beal became, I think, a very talented player, but he was not, on those first trips, very talented. He was brand new to the game. And so he was pretty easy pickings, but you know, if he sits down to play heads up and all of a sudden the table fills up and there's a waiting list, well, then if he's going to get bored and leave, then that doesn't help anybody. Or if they play him and then somebody goes to his room and says, hey, how about, you know, let's, you know, you and I go to this casino. It's a nicer place. We'll go play there. Or, hey, you're going back to Texas. Why don't I, you know, like hop on the flight with you? You know, we'll go play, you know, that it is like a gentlemanly thing. I'm completely above board, but it's like, you know, they sort of reached an agreement, these competitors and friends among the high stakes community, that they weren't going to try to poach Andy, that if he wanted to play heads up, then they would take turns playing him. They'd combine their bankroll. This was something he knew about, but that it was, you know, that everybody was fine with this arrangement, but because Ted wasn't involved in it on this first time, he just showed up and saw a high stakes game with one guy that he figured that, you know, there was no way he could lose to, and so he bought in.
Well, just out of curiosity, what is the Bellagio or the Aria, what do they rake when, like when Andy's here playing Todd and they each have $5 million on the table, What do they rake?
I have when they played at the Wynn, I was able to get one of the table placards that you know that says you know like you know Wynn Casino limit hold'em $50,000, $100,000 bets, $25,000, $50,000 blinds. I can send it to you. You can put it on your site. It's one of my favorite, one of my personal mementos.
But that plaque isn't used very often,
right? it says on it table fee $100 per hour. What happened, you know, when I was
that
when
seems,
I was
there. That's almost nothing.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm shocked that it's that low.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't know the specifics, but I know, like, you know, if we went to Aria and we played, you know, like the, I don't know, $2, $5 no limit game, we're paying, whatever the rake is per pot. If we play
more than $100 an hour.
Right. But if we go and we play like a $300, $600 game, like, you know, even like a limit game, it's like, or actually if we play like a medium stakes game and they're no longer raking from the table, the hourly might be like $10, $15, $20 an hour. And if we play super high stakes, well, it might be like $25 an hour, $40. I mean, when you play really big stakes, the rake is incredibly, incredibly tiny. The poker rooms make, I think, a ridiculously small amount of money off of high stakes poker. It obviously is a great marketing tool either for the casino or for the poker room in general, or because the guy who wins $2 million in a high stakes poker game is going to stop by the craps table on the way out and give it back so that, you know, the casinos have a good motivation. But based on how well the high-stakes poker players get treated, it's way out of proportion to the amount of money that the casino makes from them when they're
at
playing
the high-stakes
game.
At least at the poker room.
Yes.
Yeah. Some of them leave their money in other ways at the casinos.
Absolutely.
Well, but when it's a smaller rake, that's usually figured on 8, 9, 10 guys at a table, and they're getting this rake from each of them. When it's heads up, there's only two of them to pay. So it's $100. So it's only – they each pay $100. Yeah. Whereas on 8 people, each paying, 40 or 50 is more.
Right. So. I'm not even sure if it was a table fee that was $100 an hour total. I don't even think it was 100 for each player. I could be wrong about it. I'd have to look at my placard. But I know that it wasn't like somebody came around. You know, if we're playing $10, $20 hold'em and there's like a $6 per half hour charge, like the dealer each half hour announces it and everybody like hands in the money. In the higher stakes games, when they do that, usually the players will just say time pot, and they'll take, you know, out of the next pot for, you know, what the rake is, you know, what the fee is for that half hour or hour from the next pot with all the players' agreement. Here, what happened is they just kept track of the number of hours, and at the end of it, went to the person who won and said, you played 27 and a half hours, so it's $2,750. Obviously, the guy who won $5 million or lost $5 million isn't going to say, well, I need to get $1,350 of it from the guys who lost.
Now, Howard Lederer, he was one of the players who did the best against Andy Beal. And this was before Full Tilt. Recently, when Full Tilt went under, Howard Lederer took a lot of the blame and was for a while the most hated guy in poker, at least in American poker. Is it your opinion that he will resurrect his image and be able to resume a life as a top poker player?
I think he will if he wants to. I'm friendly with Howard, and I think he wants to do that. He certainly plays some and wants to play more. And, you know, who wants to be even just, you know, tangentially part of a community where people hate you, even if they are incorrect to hate you? Nobody likes to be disliked, and certainly distracts from your enjoyment of the experience if you know that there's like seething resentment against you. So I think that he wants to, and I think that, you know, he will and should return to the poker community. Obviously, you know, part of this is because I'm friendly with Howard, but I sort of think I would not be friendly with him if I thought he was a crook. I researched Full Tilt situation pretty carefully because I spent about a year working on a book that I ultimately could not sell to a publisher, but about the rise and fall of Full Tilt. And I think that Howard, did a very poor job of public relations, that when Full Tilt was going down and he was focused on trying to find a buyer for the company to get the players paid off, that was a smart thing to do. But by, you know, being the public face of Full Tilt Poker and saying nothing during this time, and, you know, having other players saying things, or, you know, people making accusations and not responding, it let, you know, got a very negative opinion to, you know, become strongly held. I don't think that he necessarily helped his case in the interviews that he did a couple years ago. But I think his problem is a public relations problem. I think he was helpful in establishing the company as a strong company. He was not actively part of the management, nor was Chris Ferguson, during the several years before Full Tilt got shut down. And, you know, my own investigation was that, you know, as of a couple years before, everybody in the company, except for a few people in management, had this idea that the company was not paying its owners monthly dividends until, you know, it had 100% coverage of, you know, player money on account, you know, saved up in segregated accounts. And so it was, you know, the sense of betrayal of people in Full Tilt against Howard was, you know, we thought, you know, you were taking care of this here. And, you know, Howard's attitude was, you know, I thought the same thing you thought, that we were covered. And so it was, you know, it was a complicated situation. I think he made some, you know, he made some mistakes. Certainly, you know, this idea that he was on the cover of Bluff as, you know, the most powerful man in poker, and that's the month that Full Tilt went down. You're setting yourself up for a fall. And I think he admits, I don't know if he has publicly, but I've talked with him about it. And I think he would be willing to say it publicly that, you know, he rode that wave and let people think he was a genius for everything he did for Full Tilt, even, you know, years after he was, you know, in the levers operating it. And so he was stuck there when, you know, its reputation turned bad overnight, that he'd taken all this credit. And so now, you know, he was stuck with the blame. I don't think anybody who looks at it carefully would say, well, that he stole money or that he took money under false pretenses. I think he handled the situation poorly in a number of ways. I know that there was a column recently by Daniel Negreanu, who's been very critical of Howard and, you know, has been good friends with some of the people who have, you know, criticized Howard, and he himself has criticized Howard, that, you know, Daniel said, I don't think he should be banned from the World Series. You know, I think that, you know, he made some mistakes, but I think I don't think he stole money from people. I think he was trying to save the company, but, you know, definitely made mistakes. He shouldn't be barred from poker the same as somebody who was, found cheating poker players out of money.
That was actually a generous thing for Negreanu to say. Daniel had been leading the charge against both Howard and his sister for some years now. And so saying they both should be allowed to play,
right,
was a generous thing for him to do.
I agree. I think that, you know, I'm friendly with Daniel. I mean, I'm very good friends with Annie and with Howard. I'm not as close with Daniel. I haven't been in touch with him in the last few years. I like him, and he's always been friendly and helpful to me. And so, you know, it's always hurt me over the last several years that Daniel, who, you know, was nice to me, he let me interview him for The Professor, The Banker, and The Suicide King. I wrote a couple articles about him for a poker magazine, not even necessarily complimentary ones, but, you know, like stories he told me about his bad times. And, you know, he was always cool with that. And, you know, the idea that he's out there and he hates people that I'm friends with, and that I'm friends with these people who, you know, who dislike him. You know, I like everybody to get along. I like it when people, and people I know get to know other people I know, and everybody likes each other, even though they're all trying to take each other's money, which is the case in poker.
You're now writing for Poker Stars in some kind of a nebulous category that comes up with an article that mentions gambling with an edge in the Calvin Iyer website. And so now, what is your writing deal with Poker Stars?
I did some writing for Poker Stars last fall. They were considering a site about success in, you know, in gambling, success in strategy, success in business. And I wrote some articles, and they liked the articles. I don't think they went forward with the site, but they asked me if I'd like to do some writing for them on a variety of platforms that they would sponsor. That would include writing profiles about, you know, about risk takers and, you know, independent, intelligent, interesting people, as well as, you know, placing those in outside publications under the clearly marked sponsorship of PokerStars, but not really about PokerStars, as well as doing some writing for PokerStars. We're kind of hashing it out. They're still trying to figure out exactly how best to use me, and I'm trying to figure out, well, not how best to use them, but how to, you know, provide them value in a way that will, you know, get them to keep sponsoring me to write about things I really want to write about. So I wrote an article about Alexander Dreyfus, the entrepreneur behind the Global Poker Index and the American Poker Awards.
What is the Global Poker Index?
The Global Poker Index, which actually Alex Dreyfus acquired out of the bankruptcy of Federated Sports and Gaming, which was a company that I was involved with, and the Global Poker Index kind of came from that, is a means of ranking tournament poker players. It would be like the
chess rating system.
Yes, or in tennis or golf, where it takes the top results for a certain period and top results from prior periods, and individual results are weighted based on, you know, quality or size of event. And so it's basically a formula that says, you know, is, you know, who, you know, who's a better poker player, Phil Ivey or Daniel Negreanu? Obviously, this doesn't tell who's a better poker player, but it's fodder for the argument where if you say, well, Phil Ivey won more money last year, and somebody can say, well, yeah, well, but, you know, Phil won, you know, three events with $250,000 buy-ins that only had a dozen people in it, whereas Negreanu won these two tournaments that had 1,000 people. You know, so it allows you to, you know, compare apples to oranges in tournaments. And I mean, it was a cool thing. I was really pleased when I was involved in Federated that I was involved in getting it off the ground. And I think it was a smart thing for Alex Dreyfus to acquire. And he's kind of using that as like the centerpiece of his vision for poker, which include, you know, he wants poker. And this was the idea to some degree behind Federated and behind a lot of people who are trying to boost poker, is, you know, to, you know, make poker more of a spectator activity, more of a sport, you know, more standardized, more friendly for advertisers, more friendly for spectators. And that, you know, he's using that to go about it.
It also seems like there's a big push to get more recreational players into the game, which I saw a couple of articles this week. Daniel Negreanu was talking about it in one of them. I mean, is he behind that as well?
Dreyfus, I think, is focused on sort of like the larger issue. He doesn't operate a casino or a poker room or an online poker site or a poker tour. And so, you know, to him, the idea of, you know, getting more people to enter a tournament or more people to play is not really central. He's trying to, you know, he's trying to figure out, at least in a general sense, you know, how do I get more people interested in poker? And there are a lot of people the amount of people who watch golf isn't necessarily dependent on the number of people who are regular players. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's a connection, but golf is actually a great example. I mean, I don't know if you guys have ever been to a golf tournament, but it's like the worst thing in the world to try to watch live. I mean, there's absolutely nothing whatsoever redeeming. And I apologize to people who like going to golf tournaments, but there is nothing of, you know, as a sports spectator, redeeming about watching golf live. But I think it's fascinating the way they put it together on television, because they use, you know, you have different people, you know, different players on different parts of the course, and they have no idea really how each other are doing. But in the broadcast booth, I guess it's the equivalent of the hole card cameras, in the broadcast booth, they can tell you that, you know, this guy is 6 under par, but he's 3 under for the last 3 holes, and this other guy was 10 under, but he's just given back 2 strokes. And so now all of a sudden, you know, one player is back in the game. If you're at the golf course, other than occasionally like seeing, you know, like the leaderboard, which is pretty much like a chalkboard or something like that, you don't have any idea what's going on while you're watching it. And so, you know, I think what Dreyfus wants to do is he wants poker to attract tennis player money, golfer money, and, you know, that kind of sponsorship money, which I think would be a great thing, at least, you know, as somebody who enjoys poker. And obviously, you know, that would be related to more people will play if they enjoy what they're watching.
Yeah, well, now the players are putting up all the money. It'd be a whole different thing if suddenly it was sponsored and the casinos or somebody else was putting up the prize money.
Right, and the business that I was involved in, Federated Sports and Gaming, which, you know, unfortunately didn't work out and left some people feeling like, you know, they, you know, they had equity in a free roll that didn't take place because the company went bankrupt. They, you know, that's, you know, a lot of people don't like Annie Duke because of that. But I mean, that was, you know, that was the vision of it. It was, you know, let's have events with top professionals. We're going to add money to them. We're going to add equity to them. Let's not make the athletes put up all the money. Obviously, you know, it was one of these bootstrap things that, you know, we'll use our startup capital to subsidize the player pools and things like that. And then if, you know, we get the players, then the advertisers may come in, and then we can use the advertiser money to do that. And then the next thing you know, it'll be like the PGA Tour, where I think the players pay like a nominal $100 a week to enter a tournament. But obviously, entry fees don't have anything to do with the prize money on PGA Tour events. But, you know, it never got to that point. Instead, they burned through their startup cash and, you know, went under after three events, and obviously didn't have the season-ending free roll. And people, you know, who felt like, well, you know, I, you know, had bought into these tournaments and had X amount of equity, I can understand why they're upset. But, you know, it wasn't, you know, I don't feel like my pockets or anybody else's pockets got lined. I thought it was an idea that just didn't work out, but would be ideal in, you know, in any sort of professional gambling, if you could have people display their skills and have audiences interested and have sponsors pay to have people watch it.
You have a Twitter handle named @MikeCraigIsAmuck. What kind of idiot are you thinks people know how to spell amuck?
The same kind of idiot who, if you look for my Facebook page, it's Facebook.com/WriteMichaelCraig. And write is WRITE, whereas most people think it's RIGHT.
That'd be wrong.
Right. And so I originally had like a Full Tilt handle back when I was doing work for Full Tilt. Obviously, when I stopped working for Full Tilt, I didn't use that handle, but I, you know, just kind of made one up. And I used to have an email address, and I had people who called me Mr. Chaotic, and I couldn't find a Mike Craig Chaotic type Twitter handle. And so I said, well, okay, well, amok, you know, A-M-O-K. It's an obscure word that people kind of generally heard of, but it is obscure. So I thought, well, Mike Craig is a muck. I'll use that. And it was a bad idea. I've actually been on Twitter now like about 7 years, and I'm only recently starting to understand the importance of social media and try to participate in it. And I'm, you know, I would love people to go to, you know, Mike Craig is a muck and suggest to me better handles. I would, you know, I, if I were smart enough, I'd come up with a contest to come up with one for me, but I am not that smart, because if I was that smart, I would have come up with a better Twitter handle or a better Facebook page, which is what I want to direct people to, because, you know, I'm writing for a bunch of different places in this deal with PokerStars, and I want people to come look at the articles.
I just recently got onto Twitter, and I realized, you know, I never gave any thought to what the handle should be. I mean, I now think I should have used like Gambling with an Edge or something instead of,
it's not too late,
RWM21. But then I don't know what happens. Like, do you lose all your followers, or can you change your handle in the middle? I don't know. Anyway, for people who are thinking about getting onto Twitter, give some thought to what your Twitter handle is.
Right, and I'm not the person that you should have on the show to advise you on
that.
Well,
it's not terrible. Mike Craig is a muck is clearly better than Mike Craig is a schmuck. So, and they're only a little bit different. Yeah. So now you describe yourself as a word artist, this gun for hire. Now, it doesn't sound like you're really in need of extra writing gigs. It sounds like you got quite a few there.
Well, I always like to, you know, I like to think of myself as an artist among business people and a business person among artists. I mean, if I had a choice of being Van Gogh or Picasso, or Van Gogh or Andy Warhol, I would take Picasso or Warhol.
Guys, you like your ear.
Yeah, and, you know, and guys who, you know, during their lives were, you know, led great lives and were happy and had, you know, sycophants and, you know,
and fabulously wealthy.
Yeah, fabulously wealthy, and, you know, could, like, you know, draw something on a restaurant tab and just give that to the waiter instead of paying the check, and have, you know, the waiter say, this is way better than the $50 you owe for lunch. Whereas Van Gogh didn't sell any paintings, you know, was, you know, seriously unhappy and depressed, and you know, I want to say he killed himself. I think he did, but I'm not a close enough studier of Van Gogh. Again, because he didn't make enough money, I didn't follow him as closely. But I, you know, I really enjoy writing. I like communicating. I think I'm quite good at it.
I think you are too.
Well, thank you.
And we had some more questions for you. We're going to do a few commercials, and then we're getting back. We're talking to Mike Craig, author of The Professor, the Banker, and the Suicide King. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more games than anybody else has. Throughout March, there'll be two separate casino-wide progressives running 24/7 in the $600,000 March Money Madness. The bigger the two progressives begins at $10,000 and must be hit before it reaches $25,000. One winner will get the big prize each time, and everybody actively playing with a player's card earns $25 in free play when it goes off. Immediately thereafter, it starts again at $10,000. Simultaneously, there's another progressive beginning at $1,000, which must be hit by $2,500. This, too, will start again immediately after it's hit, and is predicted to be hit three times a day all month long. If you wear green on St. Patrick's Day, Tuesday, March 17th, midnight to midnight, or even if you don't, you'll get 2x points on all video poker machines and 5x points on slots and video cells. All machines, no exceptions, no limit. Next Wednesday's class at it's noon in the Grandview Lounge will be 9-7 triple-double bonus. This game is like double-double bonus, except when you get four aces and a kicker, you receive a full 4,000 coins rather than the 2,000. And when you receive four twos, threes, and fours with a kicker, you get 2,000 coins rather than 800. You pay for these high bonuses by only receiving 10 coins when you get three of a kind rather than the usual 15. It's a game for excitement junkies because it has a sky-high variance. If you're on a Social Security with very limited bankroll, this isn't the game for you. At the Palms, on the weekly 7 p.m. drawings on Fridays, winners share $10,000. You don't need to be there to win, but you must collect by midnight. They offer 2x points in the afternoon, 2x drawing entries in the afternoon between 4 p.m. and 6:30 on Friday. And then starting at 7:46 through midnight, there'll be 5x drawing entries for the following week's drawings. Play for points through Friday, March 13th will be for real cash money. You can earn up to $190 per day, Monday through Friday. And this may be earned and redeemed whenever the booth is open at a rate of 0.20%. You keep your rate. You keep your points. So this is actually very close to double points. Their basic points are 0.25. So this is you're earning cash an additional 0.20. So it's 1.8 points, something like that. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play a lot of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the games. It's a good site to practice quick quads, for example. You can get the strategy from me or from Michael Shackelford's Wizard of Odds website. But if you want to play, if you want correction, you go to videopoker.com. For most players, you have no idea how badly you really play until you have a computer program correcting your mistakes. The game of the week at videopoker.com is Hot Roll Poker. This is a 10 coins per line game where you use regular strategy and periodically some dice roll and serve as a multiplier. It's very similar to Super Times Pay, but it has some key differences. In Super Times Pay, you don't know how the multipliers are weighted. In Hot Roll, you do. Since the dice are being depicted, you're going. They have to act like regular dice. So you're going to end up with a multiplier of 2 or 12 each, 1 out of 36 times. Or you'll end up with a 3 or 11 each, 2 out of 36 times. So it's the same weight as in regular dice. The average number, of course, is 7, which is much higher than you get in Super Times Pay. But then again, you are paying 10 coins per line rather than the 6 in Super Times Pay. So there's no change required in your strategy. This will add EV and variance, but no change is required. All right. We're talking with Michael Craig, author of The Professor, the Banker, and the Suicide King. Two articles of his that I want to suggest the readers go look up. One is on the blackjack ball. This was posted just a couple days ago. So if you look up, if you Google Michael Craig blackjack ball, you'll hear a story about, you'll read a short story about the 2015 blackjack ball. Now, we've talked about that ball extensively on the show, and but this, he has a different take on it than we have on the show. Another one that I recommend you read has nothing to do with gambling at all. It's a biography of Ernie Banks, who died a month and a half ago. 5 weeks after he passed, Michael tweeted out an article that he wrote 15 years ago. I enjoyed the article. So if you're at all a baseball fan, go ahead and Google Ernie Banks, Michael Craig, and you'll get the article.
I'd be thrilled just, you know, like to end up on search engines, Ernie Banks, Michael Craig. That showing that moving up in search engines, that's payment enough for me.
In that case, you don't have to read the articles. Just go into Google, and if he can get to trending, he's going to be happy. All right. Now, in the category of politics makes strange bedfellows, Poker Stars and Caesars Entertainment are now joining forces to help push interstate internet gambling. Caesars has been against PokerStars' entry in the United States online gaming market, but since they're facing one of the richest men in the world, Sheldon Adelson, who's on the other side of this contest, I suppose it helps to have another deep pocket on your own side. So now you're in the poker media, Michael Craig. What do you make of all this?
Okay, well, as I mentioned, I am involved in this deal with PokerStars. I did disclose that before. I think Sheldon Adelson is such a genius. I mean, if he loses this fight, imagine how many more billions of dollars he's going to make from online gambling. I think that's he's found a great middle here. Oppose it and win, and, you know, he locks out a competitor. Oppose it and lose, and he'll make another fortune in online gambling. Great idea.
So, all right. So a lot of players have been calling Sheldon Adelson an idiot. You're here calling him a genius. That's interesting.
Well, I'm certainly, you know, obviously, I'm in favor of legalization of online poker and other forms of internet gambling. But I find it interesting that if he loses this fight, his net worth will definitely, over the long run, be much higher than if he wins it.
All right, we got about 1 minute left. I went on YouTube and found an old video you did on Turbo Poker. So how much of a poker player are you? Have you had any success? Are you still doing it?
I'm not playing that much anymore. I'm hoping to come back to the World Series this year now that I'm involved in writing about poker again. I played a number of years at the World Series. I made 3 final tables. I played as a friend of Full Tilt for a number of years and did well in tournaments, primarily because I edited the Full Tilt Poker Strategy Guide, and I got people like Howard Lederer and Chris Ferguson to spend months teaching me how to play tournament poker. That worked wonders playing $30 and $50 tournaments online and occasionally at the World Series of Poker.
Making a final table or two sounds like you're, you know what you're talking about.
At least I can use it as a credential to let people think I know what I'm talking about.
All right. We've been talking to Michael Craig, author of The Professor, Banker, and The Suicide King. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.